Take a network break. Grab a virtual donut and join us for our weekly analysis of what's happening in IT. Today, we're covering the latest Huawei controversy, new service mesh offerings, and some hopeful sci-fi, among other stories. We've got a special guest today, Denise Donahue. She is business architect at NetCraftsman. She's joining us for our analysis. Today's show is sponsored in part by InterOptic. InterOptic offers high-performance, high-quality optics at a fraction of the cost. Don't be fooled by lesser optics. The difference between generic third-party and brand-equivalent optics matters. Go to interoptic.com to learn more. And stay tuned after the podcast for a Tech Bytes episode sponsored by HPE and Intel. We're going to get details about Composable Fabric. This is the networking solution from HPE. Combines top-of-rack switches and automation software to pool networking resources to help you scale your data center. We're also talking about how Composable Fabric integrates with HPE's SimpliVity Hyperconverged portfolio. So stay tuned after the news for that.
It's cool, too. It's cool. It's worth listening to because you don't sort of think of HPE as having a dynamic data center strategy outside of buying Arista stuff. So it was really interesting to hear what they've done with the Plexi acquisition.
Yeah, it's coming from Plexi. So yeah, it's interesting stuff. So take a listen. All right, to what's happening. Last weekend, Canadian authorities arrested Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou at the behest of the United States. The U.S. wants to extradite Meng to face charges of violating sanctions against Iran. And as of today's recording, Meng's extradition hearing was still ongoing.
This comes from the Where Tech Meets Politics portfolio of articles at Packet Pushers.
It seems like we've been talking about that a lot lately, yes.
Yeah, and I did flag this up when we first started talking about it. And again, I just want to reiterate, I'm not taking a stance on politics here. What I want to do is just talk about how this affects the technology industry and try and delve into and do some sort of analysis of where that comes. Now, the point here is that she's the CFO, and she was actually in transit in Canada, which is quite amazing. So she was actually deplaning and replaning to fly somewhere else, which I thought was really interesting. And she is actually being arrested by the U.S. law enforcement using extradition treaties with Canada. It's not a political move at all. And apparently, according to some of the articles that I read, the White House was unaware that this was actually happening until after the news broke. So this is a legal matter related to sanctions that were put in place in Iran some time ago. And I think basically the crux of the matter is that the CFO made some statement somewhere that there was a company in Hong Kong called Skycom, and they said that Skycom was not Huawei. It's nothing to do with Huawei. And then at some point later on, she made a statement that Skycom and Huawei are the same thing, or some evidence came to the same. And so now the U.S. law enforcement wants to take Huawei down on the basis of the fact that they broke legally enforceable sanctions against Iran.
Yeah, apparently Skycom tried to sell HPE equipment to Iran, which is a violation of U.S. sanctions, and that U.S. generated equipment can't be sold to Iran. And there's also some potential bank fraud now being alleged with a global bank as part of the deal. So yeah, this is getting stickier and stickier.
Well, did anybody ever think that Huawei was a really ethical company in the beginning?
It's not their reputation, no.
Well, I suspect, I mean, we'll talk more about this in the next part where we talk about, there's a second matter with Huawei this week where they're losing the account of British Telecom or BT in the UK. And I'll talk more about this. I actually think here that what's happening here is you're actually seeing how immature certain parts of Chinese organizations are. Like this exact same thing happens to Western companies. They just don't seem to get caught so much. And they're much more careful about holding these things at arm's length. Now, maybe it's because Huawei's got a privileged position with the Chinese government in China, and they can get coverage. But when they come outside of China, they have these lessons where they need to be much more cognizant of the law and the reach of legal powers because they might be a little bit freer of it. But also, you know, basically what I think here is that, you know, Huawei's got some hard-charging business of executives who want money at any price. That should sound familiar. That sounds like any IT vendor when you deal with their executives. The only conversation is money, profit, and how do I get more customers or get customers who give me more profits for less effort. So that's not new. I think the challenge here is that they sort of did some stuff where they said, we want to do this deal, try and do something to hold it at arm's length, and they didn't do it very well, and now they've been caught out. Mm. And of course, it's been instantly politicized because it was literally like hours after
President Trump and Xi Jinping met in Argentina, I believe, yeah, at a summit.
Yeah. And said, we're going to resume normal trade relations or work together to solve some problems. And then, of course, the U.S. law enforcement arrests the CFO of a major Chinese company. That's not a good look, but it does appear to be unrelated and coincidental.
And it did get some Silicon Valley executives worried about potentially traveling in China if there would be any kind of retaliation.
Indeed. Well, that was a tweet I put out, which was like, if you're a U.S. tech executive, do you actually want to fly to China? And apparently Cisco did actually send out an email telling employees not to travel to China for a while. And then it rescinded that email shortly thereafter, because obviously that's bad PR, right? That is not. You don't want to offend your Chinese partners by saying we can't go to China. So
that's something you want to do quietly.
Right.
Yes. It requires manager's approval. And by the way, managers don't approve.
That's right.
Down on the down low, HR is sending confidential emails to executive managers saying travel to China for the time being should be, you know, needs only, you know, basis and approved at the highest levels or something like that. Because Cisco doesn't want to see its executives arrested in China in a tit for tat arrangement.
All right. So we do have other Huawei related news. As you mentioned, Greg, BT British Telecom says it's ripping out Huawei equipment from, quote, key areas of its 4G network, unquote, according to a story in The Guardian. BT says it's part of a policy the company enacted in 2016, quote, to not have the Chinese firm at the center of its infrastructure.
Okay, so now this is, strap yourself in, it's a big story, and I'll have a blog post on this, which is running out about 1,500 words, hopefully by the time you hear this. So it turns out that in the UK, in 2014, when they selected Huawei as the winning bidder for the 3G, 4G core, the UK government said yes, but there's a security risk. So what we're going to do is instantiate a security body to have oversight on Huawei equipment, and Huawei has to provide them with software and security reviews, and they work together to make sure. So there's a body, the oversight board is a part of the NCSC, and I'll give you a link to the UK report. And basically what's happened is Huawei is not able to satisfy the oversight board that it's actually producing products of A, sufficient quality, so that they're literally concerned about the quality of the product. In fact, they're more concerned about that than the security risk. And they're also finding that every time Huawei submits the code, the source code, so they get the source code of Huawei here in the UK every time it comes in, and it goes to this body for examination, and then they examine it, and then they look for the code that then goes to the product. When Huawei takes the code and puts it in the product, they run an obfuscation mechanism. Now, my best bet is it's not so much to hide vulnerabilities. If you're giving away the source code, kind of a thing, it's as much to stop other Chinese companies from stealing their IP, right? Because you think China's stealing Western IP is a problem, apparently stealing IP from other Chinese companies is much more of a problem. But what's happening is this body can no longer, because Huawei is not able to consistently produce source code and final code, and they're not able to match it up, they can't be sure that the code that they've tested is actually what's running in the kit. And so they've actually broken down and said, there's no way that we can be sure that oversight is actually operating here. And then that has been followed up with a recommendation to stop using Huawei in BT. Very complicated, not an easy soundbite to get away.
Wow. And not what one would immediately assume on the face of it. I mean, when I read just the top level of, you know, they're ripping the Huawei stuff out, they're going to stop using it, et cetera. You know, reading it from a U.S. mindset, my thought was, oh, okay, so they've found Huawei putting in back doors and putting in, you know, the kinds of things that put that target on their back to begin with.
Well, and I've said this before, I said this last week, in Australia there was a concern about a Huawei, and they actually caught a Huawei employees giving back doors away to Chinese, what is assumed to be Chinese secret services. They certainly found back doors, but these were configured in the software by Huawei employees in Australia at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was an insider threat, not a technology threat, if that makes
sense. And not a corporate threat, which is kind of a, you know, I'm actually kind of happy to hear that it's something along the lines of not being able to, you know, follow the source code and make sure it's okay.
Well, that's not to say that they're not there. It's just that either the people who are finding them aren't talking about them. But I think of a greater concern is that, and the report is fairly good reading. It's a little bit, gets a little bit verbose in places and it's fairly tedious, but I'll have a blog post where I extract out the main things. Basically what they're saying is, I'll quote a little bit here. The identification of shortcomings in Huawei's engineering processes have exposed new risks and long-term challenges in mitigation and management, particularly due to areas of concern exposed through the proper functioning of the mitigation strategy and oversight mechanisms. The oversight board can only provide limited assurance that all risks to UK national security from Huawei's involvement in UK's critical networks have been sufficiently mitigated. We are advising the national security. Basically, if you go up to the pit where they talk about configuring management and binary equivalence, which is actually the heart of the matter, they're saying the first of these was the extraction by Huawei HQ of a subset of source code from the configuration managed repositories for onward delivery to the HCS-SEC. The second was the failure of Huawei R&D to repeatedly build a product to a consistent binary. As described in the previous oversight board, this means that any insurance is therefore currently limited. Mm-hmm. So it would probably say that Huawei's internal software development practices are a mess, and they can't actually reliably extract code, give it to the UK government for review, and then what actually gets delivered to their customers to run on the network is not the same. So therefore, no assurance. And what they're actually saying here is it's probably internally their processes are wrong. Now, if you combine that with the fact that I've spoken to any number of people who run Huawei, and they basically tell me that the product's pretty bad, like bugs are common, they do a lot of work to fix them quickly and rapidly, and they may even just ship Chinese engineers out from China to come and sit on your premises until the bugs are fixed. But the point remains is that those Chinese engineers have now become A, an insider threat, and B, you're still getting a crap product. And I think it's probably a mix up of bad product, bad product development. And we've seen this bad product development plenty. You know, it's not like Cisco, Juniper, HP, Dell. Right. Yeah. You know,
nobody's perfect.
I was going to say, I wonder if other companies like Cisco, Ericsson, Alcatel-Lucent could live up to the same level of scrutiny. Obviously, you're applying it because it's Huawei and there are security issues involved. But I've got to wonder if you applied that same level of scrutiny, would other companies match up?
Indeed. A number of people who've, you know, specifically said to me that how much problems they're having with the Nexus 9000 product line. And you would wonder, you know, you would have to say, I'm just using that as a current example, but the Nexus 9000 product line has been heavily criticized by people using it to me. And you would have to say they would have the same problems doing this because obviously their software development pipeline is pretty poor. In fact, their hardware development pipeline has been fairly weak too, which is unusual for Cisco. Normally the hardware is okay.
Yeah. So if you had Huawei stock, would you be selling it?
Already fell. It's too late. You might as well hold on now.
Yeah, buy it now while it's down. Yeah. Bounce back, catch that bounce.
I think it's confusing. I do think ultimately Huawei is a very immature networking business or a new immature company. It's got tens of thousands of employees, I believe like 120,000 employees. It's very difficult to build a company that big and keep the quality sustainable. I mean, look at what's happened to Cisco over the last 10 years as they grew from what they were to where they are now, and the variation in quality over that period of time frame. And that's a much longer established company. So I think Huawei's suffering from growing pains and just a lack of quality generally. But this is a combination of most likely it's incompetence in the software development process leading to a security position where we want to get rid of it. And if you are a national security agency, an unstable, unreliable network is a national security threat. Right.
Oh,
so
totally.
You can say national security threat and actually mean a critical part of our infrastructure is the mobile network. And we need to have something that's stable and reliable and trustable that is actually going to operate. And what I think what they're actually saying is we don't believe that the gear is stable and workable.
Yeah, I should note that in the story, Huawei equipment is still going to be used in some parts of BT's infrastructure. There's just not a wholesale rip and replace of Huawei gear. And while Huawei is not on RFPs for BT's 5G core build-out, it's still an option for non-core gear. So it's not a blanket ban on Huawei. It's just in the core of the network.
Yeah, it should be said that Huawei has, I heard a story that Huawei has an entire building with some hundreds of engineers, perhaps as many as 500 engineers, full-time trying to make their equipment go for BT.
Wow.
Yeah, now Cisco has a building of the same, but I don't believe it's quite that many. And I would imagine that most of Cisco's is actually selling it, not fixing it. But there you go.
And on a related note, Reuters is reporting that the Japanese government plans to halt government purchases of equipment from Huawei and ZTE, although private firms in Japan can still buy gear from the two Chinese companies. So Huawei's definitely got some reputational issues that it needs to address.
I think it's not reputational or security problems. I'm actually beginning to think this is operational, and the word's kind of out just how bad the gear is. And New Zealand also rejected it as well. Same thing.
Wow.
All right, moving on. Barefoot Networks, they make the programmable Tofino network ASIC. They've announced a second generation of its silicon, the Tofino 2. Tofino 2 offers 12.8 terabits total throughput. It's a fully programmable data plane using the P4 language. And this 12.8 terabit throughput brings Barefoot in line with chipsets from Broadcom and Innovium.
I didn't get far into this one, Drew. What is it that sets this aside from the Tofino 1? Like, it's not twice as fast or twice as big. Is it just a...
It's twice as fast, yeah. First Tofino was 6.4, yep.
That's right. Yes, of course. I was getting confused because Innovium came through at 7.2, wasn't it?
Innovium came out at 12.8, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So they must have respun to get the extra density inside. So this is 32 by 400 gigs. Right. Okay. That makes sense. So that's quite good. If I'm a telco or a cloud company and I'm looking at deploying these for their programmability functions, then this, especially if I'm going to use them as a edge router for the internet. So an IXP exchange where you can have fully programmable control of the packets, this is actually what you want. 32, 400 gig ports. Lovely.
Denise, you seemed excited about this announcement.
Well, I like Barefoot Networks in general. I like their ideas. I like idea of a really, really super fast chip that is programmable without taking a hit on the speed. And I really like that they're also is the that they're thinking of management when they build this too, and being able to see the packets at line speed, et cetera. I like their mindset. And so I'm really glad to see them succeeding. I was worried at first that they were going to, you know, sell out to someone like Cisco or something, but I'm glad that they haven't. I'm glad they're being adopted by other people.
Yeah, they're definitely pursuing the hyperscaler market. You mentioned their in-band network telemetry, where they can pull metadata right off the packet from the ASIC, which they're positioning as a competitive differentiator.
So it's using a 7-nanometer processor, which is quite unbelievable.
Yeah, that was the other headline from this.
Yeah, that's quite, because this is the 7-nanometers was the thing Intel couldn't get working. Remember? That was supposed to have CPUs. Now, a CPU is still more complex than a switch ASIC, but not much more.
Right, and the 7-nanometer process means that it's a much more efficient chip. So they didn't give me specific numbers on power consumption, but they said it's essentially equivalent power consumption for what you'd get from running the 6.4 terabit version. So you can double your bandwidth without also doubling your power consumption.
Now, if you want to think about what the impacts are here, think about a lot of these router chassis out there with multiple line cards getting a half a dozen 400 gig ports, or getting 20 or 30, 50 gig ports, 100 gig ports on them. This will give you up to 256 50 gig ports on there. So there's 256 gig IOs. You could probably even get a bunch of, and if you take the 50 gig E's and bond them up, you can probably even get like 100 gig ports out of a single ASIC. So think about what that means to your chassis-based routers going forward, when you'll be able to use this chip to just replace those entire chassis and throw them in the bin and replace them with a 1RU switch.
Yeah, and not only that part, I look too, so I do a lot of work with healthcare, and IoT is a huge, huge part of that and just growing. So being able to see the packets as you go through, look at the flows, you know, program it to be able to customize it for that in that way. And I guess that would work too with like public service, like with the different cameras and active shooter sensors and that kind of thing around.
I think the programmability means you can do anything with it, and that for customers is a big deal, especially at the edge of the network where speed isn't performance. The Tofinos are arguably much slower than the fixed ASICs that we get from Broadcom by comparison or other companies. So they're not necessarily the right product for really, really, really high performance, like if you're doing that big. But I do think we're going to see them in the edge in internet routers. And I think the takeaway here is if this silicon comes to market, as I expect it will, stop over-investing in chassis-based routers, because this just makes them obsolete.
Customer sampling of the Tofino 2 is going to start in the first half of 2019. If you're interested, you can go talk to Barefoot Networks and get in line.
I could put one in my house.
<That's right. laughs> Barefoot, if you're listening.
Yeah. Denise needs a fast router to connect to her Comcast connection.
Yeah. And there's the problem.
Yeah.
All right, a quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, Interoptic. 5G, IoT, 4K video, or any other high bandwidth activity is going to require smart decisions at the optics level. If you're not doing optics correctly, you're going to pay for it later. Interoptic understands you're going to need a more nimble layer zero. That's why they support the full range of product need today, and that you don't yet know you'll need tomorrow. Stop paying OEM prices for optics and start talking to the optic experts who deliver brand equivalent transceivers at a fraction of the price. And don't be fooled by lesser optics. The difference between generic, third-party, and brand equivalent optics matters. Get your optics from the company that spends a lot of time thinking about what the future of optics is going to look like. As your network gets more complex, you want to work with the optics experts who know how to troubleshoot problems when the lights go out. So head on over to interoptic.com. You can find out more how to get good optics at a low quality price. That is interoptic.com, and they will give you all the details.
Yeah, just a reminder that I went through this exercise again the week before last on how much optics costs, and found out that optics, if you buy branded, vendor-branded optics, you can easily find that they're 80% of the cost of the switch price. So when you buy a switch and you do your ROI calculations, make sure you include a full switch load of optics in the pricing and get ready to be frightened about what that looks like. And that's why you should be buying third-party optics.
All right. Yeah. Check out interoptic.com, and we thank them for being a sponsor.
Sometimes you buy them one at a time and sometimes you don't see them. And now we've got some service mesh information, Drew. We've had a rash of service mesh discussions over the last few weeks. We've talked about Istio. We talked about Google, and today it's F5.
It's F5 and VMware. We've got two commercial vendors moving into the service mesh space. First, F5, they've announced a product called Aspen Mesh. It's a commercial service mesh based on the open source Istio control plane and the Envoy proxy. It can run on any cloud application or on-premises. They give you a SaaS-based portal so you can get telemetry from the service mesh. Customers can set policies from the SaaS portal. They handle things like certificate management so you can authenticate containers and encrypt communications. And it adds RBAC for separation of duty. That's role-based access control. And it's currently in open beta.
So why not call it F5? Like, why would you create a separate company under a separate brand, call it Aspen Mesh, and not put the F5 brand on it? Don't you love it? Is it a bastard child that you want nothing to do with?
Yeah, when I saw that they rolled out a separate website and they're just making it look like it's some kind of startup or something, I thought, ooh, what does that mean? There's ways to read into that that are not good for F5.
Yeah, I just feel that this is like I don't look at F5 networks and go, innovation, forward-looking, advancement. I mean, you know, F5 networks to me is all about selling more of the same thing, you know, forcing customers into an upgrade cycle by obsoleting the existing hardware, which, by the way, working perfectly fine for just about everybody, and then selling, you know, making money out of old rope by just selling the same old thing back to customers by making the hardware obsolete.
You know, I think you just answered your question then.
Yeah.
Because if you go to you can say, hey, F5 has this new thing, then you'd be going, yeah, yeah, yeah. So, but if you go Aspen Mesh, you're like, ooh, Aspens.
Yeah.
Aspen, that makes me think outdoors and Colorado and hackers in a lab building something cool.
Yeah. And not being oversold by a bunch of old time people selling the same old thing that they were selling 15 years ago. I I've been reading F5's reports to shareholders and they've just been going on and on and on about how successful they've been in making money for selling the same thing to customers by forcing a hardware refresh through. And it's like, oh, that is not what you want to read. That said, containers and serverless are a clear threat to their business model. Cloud providers are basically offering load balancing that's better than what F5 can offer for cheaper prices than what F5 is. I can't imagine why you would deploy F5 in a public cloud when basically F5 is still out there trying to sell hardware-based load balancers as a primary thing. So I think they've got a lot of work ahead of them. The fact that they're not calling this an F5 product and just coming up with an open source project and sort of going, oh, look, you should be interested in this, doesn't exactly ring commitment, does it?
Well, I think they are experimenting. I think also they see the writing on the wall that where application development is going seems to be the microservices architecture. And if you're trying to sell folks hardware-based load balancers to sit in front of your traditional three-tier web app, that's not going to take you anywhere. And so they needed to do something. Aspen Mesh is this attempt, sort of a small skunkworks project within the larger organization to see if there's interest, get it off the ground. And I do think there will be interest in enterprises who are sort of dipping a toe in microservices architectures to have somebody sort of help them out, walk them through it, and not just deal with sort of the crusty open source software, but put a nice wrapper around it, add a few enterprise features, and do a little bit of that handholding that you can make a business out of in the open source.
And I get your point, but I think ultimately the challenge here is that F5 is so on the nose with developers, they had to come up with a different brand name. I think that's what it boils down to.
Definitely a marketing problem.
Yeah. And my customers, I see F5's reputation as being, like you said, we do this, we do load balancing. Now we work with some of the security products like StealthWatch and stuff to talk back and forth to them. But I think you're right. They've been kind of stuck in a rut. They've got to move forward. And the whole point of, well, not the whole point. One of the whole benefits of all the software-based X is being able to do the microservices and meshing all those. So if you're going to succeed, you've got to be able to play in that world. Now, why they didn't do it under F5, I think, Greg, you probably have a good point.
Well, I think so because, all the years that have gone by and it's like, I have to talk to the network team about the F5 load balance and getting a VIP configured. Yeah. It's like, I don't want anything to do with F5, and they really haven't done a good job of making that a fun experience for developers. I mean, I've spoken to a few DevOps people over the years and they've gone like, I'm never going near, I think that's a problem. So perhaps we'll see. I mean, but let's compare that to what VMware's done, Drew.
Yeah, so F5 isn't the only one getting into service meshes and bringing it to the enterprise. VMware has announced NSX Service Mesh. It's also based on Istio. This plugs into other NSX services. It extends service discovery, so they'll give you more detail than you'd get necessarily from just Istio about data being accessed and the users initiating the transaction. And I think the big thing here is that they're talking about essentially giving you a common policy framework across multiple clouds. So if you're developing in AWS, if you're developing in Google, et cetera, you can run this NSX service mesh and have that common framework and policy model.
Okay, so just compare this announcement, the VMware NSX, with the F5 announcement, just how different this is, right? This is all in. They announced a product. It's a full product. It's part of the NSX. VMware is all in with containers and all in with cloud. Much more convincing story. They've got the Pivotal Container Service that they've been working on. They've been working on serverless extensions getting connected. They've got VMware on AWS so that you can bring it on-prem, off-prem. So they've announced their container support as part of their NSXT strategy, right? So just compare and contrast this. This isn't like, oh, we'll create an open source project and hope people come and get a part of this. This is, boom, full product, service mesh with our brand name, part of our existing strategy, strap it into your existing controller, do multi-cloud, away you go.
A very different approach, a very, very clear approach that, yes, that VMware is relevant in the microservices era. They have a product for you. And I think they're also, the first version of this is tied to Cloud PKS, which is VMware's Kubernetes as a service offering. Also, so very much also a way to lock you into VMware's container and mesh service strategy.
Which could be seen as good or bad, depending on what your thought about yes. VMware is. Yeah. I really like the VMware's mindset on this, in that the common policy framework, not only across multiple clouds, but it seems to me that where they're going with NSX in general, it's like NSXX, you know, like SDX.
Yes.
It's like everything is getting rolled into that. Then when you look at the VeloCloud acquisition and how they're rolling that into, this is NSX SD-WAN.
That's right.
Based on VeloCloud. So if you can take policies and do them as close to end-to-end as possible, then you win, I think.
Mm. I think service mesh is really exciting. I think I've been banging on about service mesh for more than a year now, saying just how transformational this is for clouds. It takes away the whole dependency on the cloud network itself. And anybody who's run a distributed system, you'd call it a network, knows how hard it is to run run containers. You know, I'm just looking at people running containers and having a laugh, because as soon as they get to more than 100 to 200 containers, they start to realize they've got some real networking problems. They don't know where everything is. And they don't know which containers are talking to which containers as part of the app and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And so service mesh is an attempt to reestablish what is actually a network, so that you've got clear points of control and you can actually get visibility into what's happening. So I think NSX is a little bit slow here. Cisco's already announced some stuff around service mesh, so it is a little bit behind the curve. But I do think they've got much more credibility here, in the sense that it can snap it into the existing NSX portfolio and say, right, we've got solutions for bare metal. We've got solutions, you know, NSXT is bare metal now. Got solutions for your VMs. Of course, you've probably got our VMs in your data center. We've got it for cloud. We've got VMware in AWS. You've got VMware AWS on-prem. We've got all the different options, and we can bring them all together with a public cloud offering. Why would you go anywhere else? I mean, NSX is expensive, but, you know, it's the loving bosom of everything that you want out of this sort of stuff.
I would actually disagree that they're behind the curve. I think F5 and VMware are both actually, to me, a little early, given that, you know, we just started hearing in earnest about service meshes, at least in our side of the house on the networking side, for the last 2 years. This is still a very new open source project, and it's coming hard on the heels of Kubernetes, which people are still digesting. So I feel like to be talking to enterprises about your microservices application development strategy when they may not even have one yet, I feel like these companies are sort of out in front.
Okay. Maybe.
You disagree. I hear the...
We have to hustle through. Maybe we'll save that argument for another day.
All right. All right, moving on. An expired certificate caused a mobile outage for tens of millions of UK users last week. The cert was in Ericsson software used by providers such as O2 and Sky Mobile.
Yeah, so not just O2 in the UK. That was the first one to be noticed, because the whole of the O2 network in the UK went out, and it caused many, many tweets from people who obviously weren't on their O2 mobile phones. Turns out that over 9 providers around the world actually had this problem. So I did some digging. Turns out that Ericsson's GGSN devices had certificates. And if you read Ericsson's press release, and there's a link to the Guardian article on this, which says, an out-of-date software license in Ericsson's system. O2 is believed to have been hit because it had recently implemented the latest version of the Swedish technology supplier's systems, but some of the licenses had expired, bringing down parts of the system. So my best guess is that what's happened here is Ericsson implemented some new code. The certificates that came in with the new code were actually expired certificates. So when they tried to phone home to the license compliance server, where you do certificate validation, that is, you validate the client certificate as well as the server to make sure that there's no risk of a man in the middle of attack, so that you can't push down third party, you know, corrupted software or something like that. You need to absolutely validate this to a high level, and Ericsson fluffed it.
That's pretty much
time.
It. Yes.
So you think this is on Ericsson, not on the companies themselves for having expired licenses?
No, in this case, Ericsson's admitted that it's their fault, and they're in the poop for certain lawsuits. So the article from The Guardian basically talks about O2's ready to receive millions of dollars from Ericsson. Now, the problem here, of course, is that Ericsson actually manages a lot of these networks as an outsource. So these networks might actually be – a company might own the rights to the license, to the spectrum licenses and the business and the revenue, but Ericsson is often tasked to actually operate the network. So there are – operating an outsourcing agreement, what is fundamentally an outsourcing agreement, and they may well be screwed. But it also happened in Japan, as I said, and a range of other companies here. Just as a bit of a snarky note, I'm willing to bet that a lot of other technology companies who make these types of software update, license subscription things, might have had a bit of a closer look at their software over the weekend to make sure it doesn't happen to them.
I would imagine. Hey, how are certificates doing? We better check those expiration dates.
Yeah. I'll bet Uncle Chuck was on the phone to people in the service provider team going, is this going to happen to us?
Yeah. Well, he should have been, and everybody should have been.
Yeah. The second part here, of course, is that this is pretty bad for Ericsson. They've had several bad years of failing in these outsourcing contracts I was just talking about to make a profit out of them for the reasons I talked about earlier, where a lot of these servicing contracts, you make no profits in the early years, and you're betting on making big profits in the later years once the network, the deployment has stabilized. And Ericsson hasn't been able to actually do that. Customers are actually expecting them to do things, and then they're losing money. So it's going to go badly for Ericsson. This is not a time when they can afford to make a mistake like this and have customers just blithely take it, roll over and put up with this. So I think it's going to be really hit them in the bottom line. And I didn't look at their share price, but I'll bet it's been fairly brutal. For those of you who don't know, a GGSN is a gateway GPRS support node, and it's part of the core network. It actually works in tandem with another thing called an SGSN, which is the serving GPRS support node. Fundamentally, it is the computer that takes the data packets coming off the 3G, 4G network and then puts them onto the router, the IP routed network as you would know it.
All right, moving on. IBM is selling $1.8 billion worth of software products to HCL. This is an India-based global technology company. Products in the sale include the old standby email platform Lotus Notes and BigFix, which manages software patches for Windows.
Can I just say that I am going to be just a little snarky here, because one of my my most loathed experiences in my entire technology career was Lotus Bloody Notes.
Yeah. Most of us are like, not only don't we sell it, like dump it someplace.
Throw it. Just go in a bin straight away. So I there was a couple of things about this that I thought. One is I've talked a few times recently about how Lotus Notes and AS400s were highly integrated, and I still regard it as the ultimate hyperconverged strategy. Not only is the back end, the AS400, effectively a HCI platform compared to what we see from Nutanix and HP and Cisco today, right? It's the same thing, but they also had the application, the unified application thing, and it's called Lotus Notes. It's a shame that IBM couldn't make it work. I did some research on the history of this. Back in October 2017, IBM announced that it was doing a deal with HCL to put some development into this. I'm coming to the conclusion that this is actually sort of like offshoring without actually offshoring. So instead of actually saying we're going to move this product development to a division in India, which IBM's been doing and had a lot of bad press for in the US, because people are saying IBM's just moving software offshore to India to get cheap labor and putting Americans out of work. And that's been a political football for them. And they've been struggling with unions and a range of other people to actually make that work. They've got several lawsuits going on in the US. I actually think what IBM's doing here is actually selling this software to HCL as a way of just avoiding the outsourcing agreement. So aggressive outsourcing continues at IBM as they try to ditch the baggage. I suspect they need to do much more along the lines of what HP and HPE did, which is you take all of your legacy assets and you drop them into a rent extraction business shell like the HPE did with all of its old stuff, and then just move forward.
Although unlike that HPE deal, they actually entered into they still own at least half of that company that they sold off those assets to. And I don't know that IBM has a stake in HCL unless they have a stake earlier that wasn't attached to this announcement.
No, I don't think so. But what it's not just Lotus Notes. It's also a bunch of other things.
Yes.
Unica, BigFix, AppScan, a bunch of other tools for stuff. HCL, I think 5 years ago, 2 years ago, IBM would have just moved these business units.
You're saying instead of having the political backlash of outsourcing, they're just selling it outright. And I think that also aligns with, IBM is struggling with its identity. What is it as a company? What businesses does it want to build around? So why not shed a bunch of legacy businesses, get a little cash for it, and try to refocus your strategic efforts and rebrand? Yeah.
But at the same time, they don't want to alienate their customers. They don't want to initiate a stampede for the door. So there's been this very gradually boiling the frog thing where they said, oh, we're going to do a deal with HCL to revamp this. Oh, now we're giving it to them, but we're containing. Oh, you should see the writing on the wall here for what it is. It's dead. You know, it's going into rent extraction. The world is over. And I don't think too many people will shed tears, to be honest.
Yeah. That was kind of when I read about that, that was my thought too. Okay, so what does this mean? What does it mean not only for IBM? What does it mean for the Lotus Notes and the other software things that they're selling?
Yeah. But in other words, they go into maintenance mode. Mm-hmm. You can maximize your profits because you don't need to advance the product. You just keep rewriting that software to keep it up to date with the latest operating systems and platforms, but you don't add new features or anything like that.
So you think HCL is just going to long tail this?
Yeah, they're the perfect company to keep that maintained. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what most of the outsourcing is. You outsource something to India or Indonesia or China or something like that and basically put it on life support and extract all the profits you can out of it for all the people who can't be bothered moving forward.
All right, moving on. Microsoft, they've announced they're adopting Chromium as their back-end engine for the Edge web browser, and Chromium is the open source project originally launched by Google, and Chromium drives Google's Chrome browser.
Just to argue with some of your syntax there, Drew, the actual rendering engine in Chrome is called Blink. And so what Edge is doing is they're switching from their own rendering engine to Google's Blink from the Chrome open source project. It's a pretty sophisticated thing. Basically, Microsoft is admitting that they can't keep developing its own rendering engine and win. I saw some interesting discussion on the Intertubes where people were talking about this is basically coming down to JavaScript and the rise of JavaScript as a multi-platform application or where your apps come from. Your desktop apps are going to be JavaScript and your phone apps are already largely JavaScript. And there's a thing called a project like Electron.js, which allows you to write desktop apps just in JavaScript, right? In Google, for Microsoft to keep developing its Edge rendering engine, it needs to get better and better at JavaScript. It needs to keep hitting a moving target. And they're struggling to do that. So they've just said, well, why are we? And they're going to just adopt Google's Blink engine and just go forward with that and wrap the Edge browser around that rendering engine. So Edge will remain. It's still a Microsoft project, but the rendering core inside of the Edge browser will become Google's Blink rendering engine.
In the post they put on GitHub, it sounded like they're not walking away from Edge, but it sounded like they were really moving to Chromium as the full back end. They would still add their own components on top as needed for differentiation and such, but based on the industry reaction, it seemed like this is pretty much Microsoft just switching to Chromium.
Yeah, it's a subtle thing, but the rendering engine is the key.
Okay.
So just to give you an understanding of how good JavaScript is or how important it is like the Apple's iPhone and the latest generations of Apple iPads actually have JavaScript hardware accelerators in the ARM CPU that Apple uses. And the performance of JavaScript apps is so far advanced in that you are actually seeing benchmarks around Electron and JavaScript Electron.js and JavaScript style apps at faster than latest generation Intel based MacBooks. Now, it's probably a fair bet to say JavaScript has won the war on the desktop via the web browser, and therefore we'll start to see Intel CPUs coming out with JavaScript accelerations. And when that happens, the game's over, right? You can't really sustain more than multiple. I mean, even Apple's WebKit is a fork of the Google Blink rendering engine or the fork of the Chrome browser with some changes made to it. So wow. We're really looking forward to a world where there's only one browser. So there'll be Firefox and Google Blink and WebKit sort of hanging off the edge. And that may be bad for the internet because the internet relies on diversity to keep it stable and sane. So it could be bad.
Wow. I didn't know all that, Greg. I didn't know about the JavaScript on the iPhones, the phones and iPads, et cetera. Cool.
Yeah, network performance is often defined by how fast an app runs. So I do to monitor various things. And you've got to pull on the thread sometimes to come up with a reason as to why this matters. I think why this matters to us is as browsers get faster and as they get heavier and heavier in their consumption, they lean into the network, they're driving network consumption. So having a consistent high-performance JavaScript rendering engine means more networking, basically.
Which is never a bad thing.
Well, and that if you really want me to break it down, it means QoS is pointless, right? Because everything's going to be HTTPS, and we're seeing HTTPS move from TCP to UDP. So if you can just run apps over HTTPS, over UDP, there's almost no traffic shaping that you can do. This is a few years out in the future. That makes sense. So I do question, you know, what does the future of the internet look like in terms of networking? How much fancy networking can we add value to? for customers beyond just adding bandwidth over time.
And speaking about the internet and diversity, the CEO of the Mozilla Foundation, which makes the Firefox browser, is mourning this move, mourning in the sad sense, mourning this move by Microsoft, essentially saying that that is now pretty much Chrome. Chrome is the default platform of the internet, and that's not great for diversity. Of course, he has a stake in this because they make a competing browser, but we'll link to his blog. You can take a look. I think he makes some compelling points. And when you look at the statistics around browser global market share, Chromium has like 64%, which is far and above the second place Firefox at 10%.
Yeah. And as I said, Apple Safari browser, which I actually use and prefer because it's actually much more better than Chrome, but it does rely on the core of the Chrome browser, which is, well, Blink, but anyway, not the hell are they. Everybody just calls it Chrome because that's how most people know. I think that's rad writing, but it's actually true. Sure.
All right, we've got a few more stories, but just a reminder to join the Packet Pushers and special guests, including Denise Donahue, for the Virtual Design Clinic on December 19th. It's a live online event. It's free to register and includes technical presentations and Ask Me Anything sessions with expert panelists. Greg, you can tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, so we've had these virtual design clinics. We've run two already, and they've been a pretty good success. We had a couple of hundred people attend each. And the idea here is that you probably can't get to conferences. And honestly, why would you? With the way that worldwide travel and the size of an airplane seat, much more comfortable to sit at home with your favorite beverage, whether it's hot or alcoholic, to suit yourself. And then join us where we actually try to put together a virtual conference type experience that you would actually want to sit through. So we're going to be covering continuous integration and continuous testing for networking. We're going to be doing network design for NVMe over Ethernet fabric. Welcome to the future, might I add. And we're also going to be having Ask Me Anything panels where you can ask network questions, and we'll get a panel of people such as Ivan Pepelniak, Denise O'Donoghue. Hello, Denise.
Hello.
Erica Cooper, and of course, some of the Packet Pushers will be there. You can actually ask your questions in advance. Head on over to packetpushers.net/AMA and lodge your question. And make sure you give us something that we can get into. If it needs to be a diagram and ask a question about why this works that, or if you've got a design challenge you want to throw out to the panel, submit your questions early so that we can actually size them up. And if we need to ask you more details and things like that, give us a chance to make that. Now, this is meant to be your type of conference. So instead of, you know, hours on a plane, getting to some rubbish hotel in the middle of nowhere that you wouldn't want to go, like San Francisco or Las Vegas, actually sit in the comfort of your own home and join in the panels live. If you head on over to packetpushers.net/VDC, you can find out all that you'll need to know.
That's right. You can get the details and links to the registration page, and we hope to see you there December 19th.
Yes, the registration isn't to harass you, by the way. It's just so that we can send you some reminders, because that seems to work okay. If we don't send reminders, people kind of forget, and that's okay. But we don't sell your details, because that would suck.
That's right. If you do want to get contacted by our sponsor, we have an opt-in option. Our sponsor is AppSella for this VDC. But that's not default. You have to check. You have to opt in to get that if you want it. So head on over to packetpushers.net/VDC and you can see it all there. Okay, back to our conversation. Zayo Group, they operate a fiber network and provide connectivity services. They've announced they're splitting into two separate companies. And Greg, I think you were calling this out to make a larger point about the development of SD-WAN.
Yeah, increasingly I'm convinced that telcos want to offer SD-WAN services to companies. They want to. They believe that they have a right to own your routers in the form of SD-WAN. And this is the transition from routed networks to SD-WAN is a great opportunity for them to get some revenue through the door. But this is a telco who has an enterprise services business and an infrastructure business. So one of them that actually specializes in burying fiber in the ground and then operating it. And then the enterprise business unit, it hasn't been able to make a profit. And the only way it's going to be able to stay alive is to actually sell off the two business units. Now, this to me is absolutely what's going to happen in the future. Companies like AT&T and Verizon think that SD-WAN is going to save them. It's not possible, in my view, for a telco to go out there and pretend that they, you know, that a mass customization is possible. You can't sell SD-WAN and then start putting firewalls and cost strategies and application routing strategies and metadata. And you're not routing packets at this point. You're actually routing applications. And the chances of them to be able to keep customers happy and to do high levels of high touch, high customization doesn't make sense. So the competitive difference or the business operational difference between large scale static network, you make one change every 5 years, versus an SD-WAN where you're almost tuning every single day on a per application basis, I don't think that's going to work. And this is Zayo basically giving up on that shared model.
Well, okay. I kind of tend to agree with you, but, which maybe is another first. But I have to ask, all right, so So maybe Zayo's giving up on it, but the big guys are not. Hmm. They're obviously seeing some kind of benefit to it. They've been doing WANs for a long time. If you think of, if you're a smallish company and you're thinking about, let me do this SD-WAN, and you know, ISP X is managing my WAN now, why wouldn't I turn to them to do my SD-WAN too?
So I think there's a couple of things there. I think there's the first one is the customer experience of owning routers was so poor. Like installing a router required somebody to go to site. Upgrading a router was a very fearful experience. And, you know, having to ship a person to site for just about every operational activity makes customers realize that owning a WAN is a nightmare. And those companies often had an advantage in that they actually had salary slaves in all of those remote locations. SD-WAN takes away all of that. Zero-touch provisioning, centralized management, centralized configuration, all that sort of stuff actually means it's possible to do this infinite configuration. And if you start putting a firewall at every branch, if you start doing intrusion detection and content scanning and all this other stuff, I don't think the telcos are going to cope with that. I think they're just going to collapse in a misery. And, you know, they're desperate for new revenue. The price per bit they're paying for MPLS and even internet bandwidth is dropping so hard. They're desperate to get out there. So I think they're going to go into this market and say, sure, we're going to price it really, really cheap so we can build this business. And customers are going to go, that's not a bad deal. And then they're going to get into it. And then they're going to go like, oh, this is not a good time.
There is a reason it was so cheap.
Yeah. I think I agree with you that it's driven by the fact that it's fairly easy to do your own SD-WAN anymore. And you, as you said, you have infinite control.
Yeah, and I think you need infinite control. It's highly desirable. Even a modestly competent network engineer can operate a very large SD-WAN much cheaper than a telco can. Now, that doesn't mean that the telcos won't go out there and waste lots and lots of money. They love wasting money on new business ideas. Look at how long ago was it when companies like Equinix and Verizon built these massive data centers with hundreds of millions of dollars and failed miserably and sold them off for a pittance against that. What about voicemail? Remember when we were all going to move voicemail and PBXs to telcos and they were going to manage those for us? How did that work out? You know, like the litany is horrible, horribly long of failed things that telcos get wrong and customers who've just been train smashed all the way through to the future, like they've had contracts with just miserable outcomes. I think you need to recognize that a telco is really good at getting a license from the government and then burying fiber in the ground. That's the two things they do really well. The last thing they do is attach some equipment to the back of it so they can rent the cable that's in the ground to other people. And that's what they're not good at. And anything else, the further and further you get away from burying fiber optic in the ground, the worse and worse they get. So really, the idea that telcos are going to run SD-WAN and give you a happy day is not actually, doesn't make sense to me. That doesn't mean they're not going to give it a go. That doesn't mean it's not going to be successful for a year or two. And then it'll be like, you know, managed PABX services. Which telcos don't run. They give them to dedicated PBX providers.
Yeah. And managed PBX services in the cloud is becoming a real thing. But that's a topic for another.
It is a real thing, but they're not run or operated by telco companies.
Right.
The managed PABXs in the cloud are actually managed by companies dedicated to that, focused on that customization, that professional services. Yeah. Telcos can't do professional services. That's hope. That's just pointless. Yeah.
Which then brings to, the future of telcos, which I guess is another discussion too.
I'll have a blog post out where I outline my case and I'll wait to be abused by everybody in the audience after that.
Something to look forward to. Yeah. All right, two more stories to go before we wrap up. Last month, Pika 8 announced that its PCOS Network OS will be available on Dell EMC N3000 campus switches. And now the two companies are extending that partnership to include Dell's S4100 10 gig aggregation switches. So just Pika 8 continuing to partner with Dell on bringing disaggregated white box switches with their PCOS to the enterprise.
Yeah, we did a podcast this week, a sponsored podcast with Arcus this week, bringing a new network operating system to market, and I like to see these new network operating systems come up with new ideas and the way to get forward. So this is good to see that Pika 8 is still pushing forward.
Yeah, and rather than try to get into the campus core of the data center, Pika 8 is actually targeting the campus edge, as a way to sort of get that toehold of that wedge into the enterprise without having to do some massive displacements.
And that worked really well. There was a time back in the day when HP ProCurve switches were being sold at the edge by the container load. And people would put their favorite chassis switch in the core, but be happy to use the ProCurves at the edge. And they made a lot of money out of that. So it's a good strategy. Can't love it.
All right, our last story. The Verge has announced a new initiative called Better Worlds. This is sci-fi short stories and little animations that go in the opposite direction of today's grim dystopian tales that dominate sci-fi and speculative fiction. And Greg, you called this out because you like this move.
Well, first of all, I'd like to have a happy ending.
Yes.
Just wanted to say that.
Oh.
Sometimes on Network Break, we always finish on a bit of a grim or a snarky story. And I thought having a happy ending would just be the best thing for a time. And this is a project from The Verge. They're actually spending money on sci-fi authors and animations and stuff like this to actually build science fiction short stories that you can actually go out and watch. Now, they're going to come out in January. And I, for one, am looking forward to it. I wanted to call it to your attention because that sounds cool.
And it's not just sci-fi, it's sort of that getting back to the roots of aspirational sci-fi when it was supposed to ignite our imaginations and sort of give us a vision of the positive possibilities and the way the things could develop.
Really awesome. Really awesome. Thank you for finding that, Greg. That just made my day. It's so depressing to see what's out there with sci-fi now.
Yeah.
It is.
Well, I do read too much dystopian fiction is a bit of a problem, or military science fiction, which is a bit of – I'm desperately trying to get away, but this is just wonderful. And it'll come out exactly the right time in January where it's the post-Christmas blues are setting in. So that should be
– That's right. Well, we have a link so you can bookmark it if you want to go check it out.
And I think it really goes along with most people's worldview too, or at least mine. I really think the future is going to be better. It's not going to be these colorless, horrible – lifestyle.
We're not
going
to be drones with our faces stuck to screens, mindlessly consuming things.
Well, we are already.
Maybe we can be better than that.
How's that better? Yeah. Well, Denise, thank you for joining us as a guest for our tech news analysis. How can folks find you on the internet?
Well, mostly on Twitter at Lady Networker, spelled LadyNetwkr. I'm trying to keep it a little shorter. That's probably the best way to find me. Or blogging at the NetCraftsman website, netcraftsman.com.
And we can also find you on the next Virtual Design Clinic. And you also are a Tech Field Day panelist.
Mm-hmm. Occasional Tech Field Day panelist. Yes, and please, I just want to put in a plug for coming up with interesting design ideas or weird design questions. It was a lot of fun the last time I did it.
Great. Yeah, see if you can stump Denise.
No, that's easy. See if you can stump Yvonne.
Well, stay tuned for our Tech Bytes conversation that's sponsored by HP and Intel. We're going to be talking about HPE's composable fabric data center automation product that's coming right up. You're listening to Tech Bytes, a short, sharp, sponsored podcast on new ideas and technologies. Today's sponsors are HPE and Intel, and we're going to discuss HPE's networking solution, Composable Fabric, and how Composable Fabric integrates with Simplivity. That's HPE's hyperconverged infrastructure product. Our guest is Garth Reed. He is Senior Strategist for the Enterprise Portfolio at HPE. Garth, welcome to the show, and get us started with a description of Composable Fabric. I believe this came from HPE's Plexi acquisition, right?
Absolutely. So Plexi had produced this top layer, top of rack solution, which, by the way, is fully compatible with Cisco networks. So it's really just positioning itself at the top of rack. And I'll stress that this is really for rack mounted environments. And so Plexi had this capability that they'd built out in the top of rack to really minimize the amount of change management required to own, operate, and do the care and feeding of all of those top of rack requirements. Uh-huh. Let me reflect a little bit on if you had a bladed infrastructure, you would have had the networking is integrated right into the blade chassis. In a rack mount environment, all of the switching would go up into the top of rack. So the difference here is we want to be able to use the, and what Plexi had created and what we acquired with Plexi was the ability to give you an integrated network experience that you'd have in a bladed chassis, but give you that experience using traditional rack mount servers.
Because when you're inside of a slash chassis and you've got like 8 blades or 16 blades and they all share that network fabric that's in the back of the blade bus, there's a bus at the back of the chassis, then the network is all there. You can configure that. And then you can, if you've got 8 chassis together, you can configure the networking between them. But I think what you're trying to say here is if you start to move to a 1RU in the rack model, then that networking model, that was a gap in the HP portfolio for the composable architecture.
In a rack mount model, yes, you'd be dependent upon the top of rack solution, which is typically coming from a different vendor. And in that context, a different set of tools to manage, et cetera.
So I think the key point here is that not everybody uses Blade servers and Blade chassis. There are times when you need the 1U, 2RU for storage systems or for high GPU densities or for high-performance compute infrastructures, and that's key. And not having them in your composable fabric would have been a heartache, I think.
Yes, absolutely. So with the composable fabric now, you've got another layer of intelligence placed on top of this. So if you watch the networking environment and you see what's happening with organizations like Barefoot, they provide an extensible operating system. If you look at companies like Arista, they provide their EOS or extensible operating environment as well. These are the ability to programmatically go at the network and allow the network to fine-tune itself in an automated fashion. So we're doing that with Plexi. So Plexi uses very traditional, standard off-the-shelf merchant chipsets in their switches. But what they're doing here is providing a software layer. So the Plexi layer in the software context is able to watch and see the application traffic across the infrastructure. So what you're getting now is a real-time feedback on the performance requirements of the application, all right, using an API that is able to see and qualify the type of traffic, the volume of traffic, the latency requirements, the latency demands from an application-to-application perspective. Feed that back into the network, and then make auto-tuning adjustments to that particular fabric. So this is the composable nature of this.
It's actually dynamically composable in a way, because Plexi was incredibly clever because it would say, I've got the network architected this way. I can send traffic. I count all the traffic flows from app to app and server to server. I'm going to reconfigure myself to optimize the architecture.
Absolutely. So without any human intervention. Now, if you want to go back a few years, we had a methodology around doing this. There is a software-defined networking capabilities. You'd be using Trill. You'd be using a spinning leaf architecture. You'd be using those types of methods around that. And what Plexi does is says, okay, stop, hang on. We can just fully package this, integrate this, and make it super easy to consume your networking capacity and guarantee that bandwidth back to the application without people having to worry about it and without having to get into that multi-layered approach that you saw in initial software-defined architectures.
And is there any kind of controller component, or is it distributed throughout the top-of-rack switches in the Plexi or the composable infrastructure architecture?
Yeah, so these are very basic, straightforward switches that we provide. We do have a trunking of the actual fiber connections across the back end, but the concept is that you just take those servers, jam their Ethernet ports, their uplink cables into the Plexi interconnects on those standard switches, and then let the Plexi software layer take over from there.
I think the other key part about this is that Plexi gives you the visibility. This doesn't happen without you seeing what's happening.
Correct.
Because for people, this idea of, the network's reconfiguring itself without me doing anything, that could be a bit scary. But the reality is lovely graphical interface, lots of data on what it's doing and why it's doing it, and you can see what's going on.
Yeah, so it gives us some insight into what's happening at the application layer, right? So, the auto-tuning, the dynamic approach to how you manage the workload balancing across the switches, across the servers, and making sure that you're getting the right packets, the right location, and the right time, right? And minimizing latency and reducing disruption at the application layer, and then guaranteeing that that service quality back to the user in terms of response times, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a far more advanced methodology than you'd have with your traditional top-of-rack switches. That dynamicism, that being able to be dynamic and responsive at that layer is really a big uptick. So this fits nicely with our strategy, as you mentioned, rack mount servers. I don't necessarily have that networking layer. Traditional networks aren't providing this. So now with this composable fabric, I've got that capability in there.
And tied into the other parts of this solution. So Simplivity is a family of products. It's servers and storage, IP storage. It's a whole converged system. And now this lets you start to bring all of those other parts of a data center into a single infrastructural component. So you don't have these orphans all over the place that you're trying to weld together.
Correct. So with Simplivity, I end up creating clusters, distributing my workload across those clusters, providing the storage layer, integrated the compute layer like you would with any other HCI infrastructure, and then laying down that composable fabric to stitch that together, but really giving you the ability to more smoothly scale all of that workload and making sure that from node to node to node, you've got great performance and great scalability. This also plays into the concept of, once we've created that cluster, we can add nodes easily and scale the whole cluster quite simply with very little effort.
So is this composable fabric, is it handling the communication between servers within a rack as well as among racks?
Yes. So we're going to bridge across multiple racks. I mean, they're just rack mount servers. So whether they're all in one humongous, 300 foot tall rack or they're spread across, we've really got that whole connection point across all of those towers.
I love the idea of my data center as a 300 foot tall rack. That's got me.
we make small racks, medium racks, big racks. I remember seeing these really tall racks and customers. It was like, what are you guys doing? How do you get out there? This is crazy, right?
But the point you're trying to make is don't imagine that it's 300 racks. It's the whole idea behind composable infrastructure is it doesn't really matter where the gear is. It all operates from a single unified console. That's the idea of composable architecture from HPE. And then the SimpliVity is saying I've got hyperconverged infrastructure. And then the Plexi part of the composable fabric says, even though I'm running a hyperconverged, I've still got a network that reaches out to the other parts of my network and brings them all into a unified whole.
Correct. Anything that talks composable, you're really talking about pooling of resources. In this context, we're able to take all of that aggregate network capability and treat it as a pooled resource and get the performance where it needs to be.
So which leads to the question, there are other data center automation products that do overlay networking in the software, such as VMware's NSX, which is a trusted partner, of course, for HPE. How does composable fabric complement or work with those other data center automation solutions?
Okay, so when you get into NSX, you're talking about an underlay and overlay, right? Where overlay is the logical network built on a physical or a real wired hard network, right? Which is the underlay. So if I look at that kind of context and saying, I want to have NSX at the soft layer to say, here's my my overlay. I want to have any level of complexity delivered and deployed through NSX for whatever particular reason, whatever governance model I have, whatever security model I have in place, whatever I want to do from a complexity aspect from NSX. Plexi is giving me the support for that in the underlay. So I want to be able to do this purely at the physical layer, at the underlay versus the overlay. So that plays nicely with NSX, where NSX says, hey, I've got templates and profiles and things that I want to push down on top of the existing physical network. Well, this physical network can also itself provide that kind of dynamic adjustments to the physical layer as required. And those NSX profiles going on top of all of that still will provide all that application layer sensitivity with respect to who needs to get routed in what particular manner when you do all the disaggregation of the networking provided by NSX.
That makes sense. So there's always partnerships there. There's interoperations. You don't leave them isolated again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if customer happens to have a Cisco shop, that's fine. I mean, we're fully compatible with that. There's no disruption to the harmony that you have on the data center floor, and it's perfectly good with us, right? This is just really making sure that the top of rack in a rack-mounted environment gets the benefits of a physical switched infrastructure that dynamically accommodates the requirements of the application layer, and will still include all of the software profiling required on the top layer, right?
So, Garth, can I use composable fabric outside of SimpliVity, or are these things tightly coupled?
Great question. So no, they are not tightly coupled. There is really good fit in intersection between SimpliVity, as it gives you that software-defined capability on the HCI layer, along with what we've got on the composable fabric. But they're mutually exclusive. We can run a composable fabric against any of your rack mount servers, whether they be our ProLiance, our DL380s, our 360s, or get into the products we have in our Apollo line, which provide for specific high-performance compute requirements or software-defined storage requirements and all the other special purpose use cases that exist for the Apollo product line. So, yeah, we can run that across any of the infrastructure requirements that our customer may have.
Hmm. Well, it's important to remember where the product came from in the sense that it was a universal networking product for the data center. And so, yeah, that makes perfect sense. It wouldn't change just because it's now part of HPE.
Yeah, so we're really happy to have this on board. It really helps to complete our portfolio. And again, it's really about giving customers what they need as a vendor. And we're happy to either acquire the right technology and bring it in, or we have a very strong partnership strategy now in the industry to say, here is our HPE complete portfolio of partners. Some of those are investments of ours, but it's really making sure customers have access to qualified reference architectures, reference configs, yes. And we can provide all that guidance.
That's right. One of the things that HP is very good at is that advice and leadership in that area.
So, Garth, we're about to wrap up this episode. If folks want to find out more about Simplivity, more about the composable fabric, where would you direct them to?
Right now, I'm simply going to the HPE.com website is a great place for that. And I provided the link for our Discover landing page. And we just came out of our Discover event. We run it twice a year in the summer in Las Vegas and in the December timeframe. A couple different locations in Europe. This year was in Madrid. So that is a landing site where you can see all of the new stuff we just announced and brought out to the market. It's really exciting times for us every time we come out of a Discover event because we've just really, you know, created a bunch of new stuff and brought out to the market and we're quite energized about our portfolio and what we're doing in the marketplace. So I'd recommend going to HPE.com or the HPE.com/discover website, and I've provided the link as well. So that would be my recommendation for some quick hints on what HPE is up to.
Fantastic. Yes, just go to hpe.com/events/discover, and we'll have that link in the show notes that accompany this podcast. Garth, thanks for joining us. We thank HPE and Intel for being sponsors. Sponsors make it possible for the Packet Pusher to bring you nerdy technical content on networking and IT. And speaking of which, you can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. Follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers. Find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on iTunes. And last but not least, remember that too much technology would never be enough.